Today's topic, as we know, is Sri Sharada Devi, the mother of all. It is said that to give a talk on Swami Vivekananda and his philosophy or his lectures and writings is relatively easy because there are so many approaches. Vivekananda was an intellectual, he was a scholar, he was a philosopher, he was a thinker. So there are a lot of material in his writings and lectures related to history, philosophy, mysticism, literature, and so on. But when you discuss the teachings of Sri Ramakrishna, you find it slightly more complex because Sri Ramakrishna's language is very simple. That simplicity itself makes him more difficult for us to understand because in that simple language he's explaining some of the most complex spiritual mysteries of religion and philosophy. Now when we come to Holy Mother Sri Sharada Devi, it is altogether totally different. You look at mother's personality. She was born in the year 1853 in a small, tiny, backward village in the middle of 19th century in India. And she was married when she was very small and married to a god man, a mystic, who considered her as his first disciple, who later became the great exponent of his spiritual message. Eventually, she became the spiritual leader of a global monastic organization founded by one of the greatest intellectuals of 19th century world, who happens to be the most celebrated speaker of the first Parliament of Religion held in 1893. So this, and then she went on to become the guiding angel, the teacher, and practically the head of the monastic organization. Vivekananda's own brother disciples looked up to her for guidance and for instruction in the complex matters of even administration of this monastic order. So you can imagine a simple woman born in a backward village in India in 1853, who hardly had any kind of education in the formal sense of the term, happens to become the leader of a monastic organization founded by the greatest celebrity and the greatest speaker who attended the Parliament of Religion in 1893. Vivekananda was acclaimed to be the greatest speaker of the first Parliament of Religion by no less an authority than Dr. Barrows himself, who wrote the well-known books, The Proceedings of the First Parliament of Religion, 1893. And he was the founder of the organization. And he was a gigantic intellect, a philosopher, a thinker. He's supposed to be the maker of what we now know to be the Neo-Vedanta, the modern exposition of Vedanta philosophy. And she, Holy Mother, was the one whose blessings helped him, according to Vivekananda himself, to create such a great impact on the 19th century religious landscape of America, Europe, and India. Now, how do you explain this? A simple person, the simplicity of her character and personality itself makes it much more complex for us to understand her. Often, you know, simplicity can be a mind-boggling source of complexity, in fact. That's what Mother was all about. On the one hand, you find her attending to some of her very, very ordinary household duties and responsibilities, looking after the needs and requirements of her ill cousins, nephews, nieces, and so on. On the other hand, you find her giving some very, 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 very decisive, very decided opinions and instructions to spiritual seekers who approach her with some very complicated spiritual problems. I can just quote one very interesting scene from here. Now, remember, you know, Vivekananda founded this Ramakrishna Order in the year 1897, and his plan was to give proper training to the novices who joined the monastic order. Now, traditionally, you find when you want to become a mendicant, or when you become a sannyasi, as we call them in India, you are supposed to spend your time always in meditation. You think of God. That's why there are so many institutions run on the latest modern commercial lines, run by the modern expert business management specialists, are making a lot of money these days. You come and meditate, your kundalini will be raised, and you can be wonderful. Now, this is our normal understanding. Well, if your mind is ready, there is nothing greater than remaining immersed in the contemplation of God. But your mind should be ready for it. But very often, our minds are not ready. So, Vivekananda devised this unique scheme. Those who joined Ramakrishna Order should be trained properly so that eventually they will be able to spend long hours in meditation. But that's a gradual evolution that should take place. But suppose, well, to give an example, you work for 15 hours in a Salesforce or Google or Tesla, whatever companies. In the evening you come and meditate. What will we be meditating upon? You'll be meditating upon the conversations you had in the office, the conflicts you had with your colleagues, and your mind will be stressful. When you come out, people may think you are meditating, but actually your mind was full of thoughts of deals, negotiations, business meetings you had, and so many things. And once in a while, maybe for a few fragments of time, you may spend your time thinking of God. That's how it happens. Now, Vivekananda understood the psychology of spiritual life. So, he said, well, those who come, first of all, they should engage in some kind of physical work. Remember, physical work. Not physical work alone. They should study scriptures. So they should be doing work with the intellect, with the mind. But they should also do physical work. Now, what is the relevance and importance of physical work? Without physical work, your mind will not be trained. Now, whatever we do with our mind, with our body, with our words, verbal, physical, intellectual activities, they will create a kind of samskara, we call in Sanskrit. It has now become part of mainstream psychology. In many of the books it is written, it is used, the word samskara. It is a residual effect after effect of whatever we do. We do something and afterwards that memory lingers on in the mental system. It will influence our character. It will create our character. Now, these samskaras are the problems we encounter when you close your eyes and try to withdraw the senses away from external world. When you are dealing with the external world, no problem. When you close your eyes, all the problems begin. Because these samskaras accumulated within the lower layers of the mental system, they come to the surface and they do not cooperate with you when you are trying to think of God. They will drag you down. How to counteract this? Do good actions, good words, good thoughts. Feed the mind with good spiritual food. Feeding the mind doesn't mean feeding the mind with ideas. It also means feeding the mind with activities, because activities create very concrete, strong samskaras. That's why people who go on doing good things cannot become bad men or bad women. People who go on doing bad things, maybe reading mystical works every day, cannot become good persons. So actions directly tell upon the mental system. Because actions become vrittis, vasanas, samskaras, sankalpas, and they constitute what we call our real personality. The personality behind the physical personality. So Vivekananda said, people who take to spiritual life, they should clean the shrine, they should collect flowers, they should cultivate gardens so that flowers will be available for puja. They should clean the floor. You may have seen in India, there is the celebrated temple of the Sikhs, Amritsar. Now, one of their very, very important ritual is you go on cleaning the floor. There'll be brooms kept there. And in one context, India's president, the equivalent of, let us say, America's equivalent of Obama, or, you know, the president of India, the head of Indian state, Indian Republic, at that time he was a Sikh gentleman, he wanted to do that so that he will acquire the spiritual merit. Remember, taking the broom, cleaning the floor, the president of the country, the ex-president. Now, why does he do that? Because Vedantic tradition, which is behind the philosophical, spiritual tradition of the Sikh religion, believes physical activities, any kind of activity, will give you a new mind. It can change your mind. It can turn your mind. Your mind starts moving and evolving, acquiring spiritual characteristics. So this is inevitable. If you go on doing some good activities, it is invariable, it is essential that your mind will become different. It helps us in our prayer, meditation, and spiritual practices. So, in one context, brahmachari, means novice, so to speak, went to Holy Mother. That's the brahmachari, some novice. He complained to Holy Mother. So, you know, I came here to become a monk, and I have to do all this work. Ramakrishna Mission at that time, even now, of course, running hospitals, schools, and so on. So he tells, in 1912, a disciple told Holy Mother Sri Sarada Devi. I'm quoting from Sri Sarada Devi and her divine play. It's a life of Holy Mother. Some say that hospital work, selling books, and accounting are not proper work for monks because the master did not do such work. Sri Ramakrishna did not recommend running hospitals and schools, so we should not run. That is his argument. But we are not Sri Ramakrishna's. If you can always remain in the thought of God, then you need not even go to a church or a temple, or even for the retreat, you need not come. Even for lecture hall, you need not come. Always immersed, like Ramana Maharshi. Or there was a, you know, recently I visited. In Spain, they considered the smallest monastery in the Christendom. It is called the Monastery Palancar in Spain, Extremadura. That's associated with Saint Peter Saint Peter, and he was the confessor of Saint Teresa of Avila. It's a tiny monastery, so he has a small, tiny cell, and he was 5'7", and he could not even lay down there. For 3 years, he sat there on a stone, resting his head on a piece of wood which was attached to the wall. For 3 years, he meditated. He slept there, sitting mostly. If you could do that, there is no need for you for going to a temple or a church, Saint Peter. He was a confessor to Saint Teresa of Avila. I think it's called the Monastery Palancar in Extremadura. It's supposed to be the tiniest monastery at that time. Later it expanded. But when he lived, it was just a small, tiny, hut-like place. It's a small, little cell. Nobody could have lived. And he stayed there for 3 years, it is said, without being aware of what was happening outside. If he could do that, then you don't have to do any physical work. So very often, you know, we want to meditate. We want to raise our kundalini. We are playing a trick with ourselves. We are deceiving ourselves. I want to meditate. I want to think of God. Some people ask the question, see, recently somebody came, not from here, from far off part of this country. He says that he, most 24 hours, he's thinking of God. For a few minutes, sometimes his mind deviates, so what to do? But he's 24 hours and he's a medical surgeon. So he imagined that 24 hours he's thinking of God. So very often spiritual life has one problem. The mind could deceive itself. And we won't be aware of it. So, see, Vivekananda said, the kindergarten, the primary school in spiritual life is doing good deeds, selfless, unselfish deeds for somebody, for something, for some noble cause, without expecting any result. That is the natural beginning, the kindergarten of spiritual education, spiritual life. So this disciple is telling mother, some people say that you joined the monastery to become a monk, and you had to work in a hospital. You have to work in a dispensary. You have to work in a school. What has it to do with spiritual life? Then, a monk is supposed to perform worship, japa, meditation, kirtan, which turn the mind to God. Other mundane physical activities turn the mind to the world. You know mother's reply. And remember, mother was a natural spiritual teacher, not a trained one. Born as such. So she could see through them to the outer veils of the mental system. She could see into our mind. So, see, mother listened carefully and then said firmly, she was officially the spiritual head of this huge monastic organization, which included some of the most learned men of India at that time. Vivekananda was just one of them. And she herself was not an academic. She didn't go to a school even. And her reply was very firm. That's how a boss deals with her or his subordinates. And you know her reply. She says, "How will you pass the whole day without work? Can anybody practice japa and meditation all 24 hours of the day?" Japa means taking holy names. You are referring to the master's life, Sri Ramakrishna's life. His life was different. Mathur provided nourishing food for him. Mathurnath Biswas was Sri Ramakrishna's disciple who looked after his physical needs. But Sri Ramakrishna could not live without thinking of God. Most spiritual seekers need a special time to think of God. Sri Ramakrishna needed a special time to think of the world. All the normal time was spent thinking of God. That was Sri Ramakrishna's problem. To think about the world was his problem, and to think about God is our problem. So, to how to make it natural for us to turn our mind to God? The only way is go on doing some noble deeds, mentally, physically, verbally, some kind of activity that will generate spiritual samskaras. And that will overturn and change our mind. And eventually, it will become natural and easy for us to turn to God. So, mothers reply firmly, how will you pass the whole 20 day without work? Can anybody practice japa and meditation all 24 hours of the day? You are referring to Sri Ramakrishna's life. His life was different. You have a regular meals because you give some service here. Otherwise, you will have to beg for your food from door to door. That's why my Narendra Vivekananda started all these centers for work. Our organization will function this way. Those who cannot adjust must leave. Now, historically, I will tell you one truth. During the course of Ramakrishna Mission's history, people who complained about the need to do some kind of physical activity left the order and went to Himalayas and spent long hours begging for food, not thinking of God, practically. So, frequently, it's like a child who wants to go to Harvard straight away or Stanford. Instead of going to kindergarten nearby, which is not an easy thing to do, where the mother will wake him up in the morning and dress him and take him in a car, take him to the nearby kindergarten. It's a big problem. I shall straight away go to Harvard. You can't do that. It's not your choice. It's not a matter of our choice. It's a matter of our evolution. Where we stand, from that state, we have to go further towards the next step. So, now, there are people who believe frequently that they can get spiritual enlightenment by some quick fix methods. Remember, we can program our body, more or less. We can program a computer, a machine, but we cannot program our mind. We can decide, we have some autonomy, which freeway you want to take, in which direction you may want to move, to the left or right. But you have no choice what thought is going to emerge in your own mind next moment. What words you are going to speak next moment, very often we can't be sure. But that verbal activity may be somewhat free to some extent. There is some autonomy, but certainly not mental activity. So, very often, we try to resort to some quick fix methods. Now, that you may, if you want more proof for this, if you read the Tripitakas, you know, the early writings of Buddha, instructions of Buddha to Buddhist monks and Buddhist nuns. It is called Tripitaka, Vinaya Pitaka, Abhidhamma Pitaka. These two deal with the disciplines and practices for Buddhist monks and nuns. Buddha was very insistent. So you find in Buddhist monasteries, in the early part of Buddhism, they have to look up to the whole place themselves. Now if you go to Franciscan monasteries, the Dominican monastery during Middle Ages, they do all the work. Even the monastery that I referred to, this Saint Peter himself was doing all the work. They didn't have paid employees, but they were all doing as part of service to Jesus. So that service to Jesus is no less a spiritual practice than meditation on Jesus. The least bit of physical activity without any thought of our own selfish purpose, without any selfish desire, as an offering to God, is a much more potent and much more powerful way of communicating, connecting with God, than putting a flower at the feet of a statue or an image. We can do that very easily. Because it is, you know, you can finish a puja in half an hour, but very often we are not willing to do work for 1 hour, for 5 minutes, because that's a waste of time. I'd rather meditate. That's a more easy, more potent pill, so to speak. I shall give an example. In Sri Ramakrishna's own life, there are some very interesting, funny episodes. And one of the funniest, humorous episode, that's what I'm referring to now. There was a gentleman, his name was Kedarnath Chatterjee. And he was a Vaishnava. And highly emotional. So Vivekananda didn't have much admiration for him. He used to shed tears. Not shedding tears the way Sri Ramakrishna did. He wanted to show to people that thought of God will make him cry. So it's just like a very sincere, good person. A little bit of, you know, modern professionalism, work orientation, or, you know, utilitarianism. He wanted some quick fix methods, easy methods to get spiritual powers. So Kedarnath Chatterjee, he believed in certain cure practices of a religious sect to which he once belonged. It's a Vaishnava sect. They have some very funny beliefs which are not sanctioned in the scriptures or by the teachings of the great teachers of religion. He held the master's big toe in his hands. So Sri Ramakrishna was sitting there, half immersed in meditation. This man would hold Sri Ramakrishna's toe. He thought somewhere in some obscure books it is written that a great spiritual leader's spiritual powers will flow to the person who holds that spirit, that toe. So Sri Ramakrishna was always meditating on God. Oh, mother, what a fool he is. He thinks that he gets all the powers by holding my toe. He was a simple person. He was meditating. He perhaps had not seen this man. But in his meditative mood, he could understand somebody, a very wonderful person, is trying to get all his spiritual powers. So it flows to the toe, big toe. But he thought that's one way of acquiring spiritual powers. It doesn't work that way. So he thought that Sri Ramakrishna's power will be transmitted to him that way. As Sri Ramakrishna regained partial consciousness, he said, "Oh, mother, what can he do by holding my toe?" Kedar sat humbly with folded hands. He was slightly nervous. He was embarrassed that Sri Ramakrishna proclaimed to the whole audience sitting there in his room that this man was trying to get all Sri Ramakrishna's powers transmitted to him by simple method, no meditation, no physical service, nothing, holding the toe. That's how many people believe about spirituality. So mother says, it's a very interesting, very, very, very important message. Now, what is the psychological explanation of this? You know, our mental system, or our true personality, as I mentioned earlier, is constituted by our samskaras, impressions, memories, attitudes, emotions, feelings, and so on. All these are generated by our activities, physical activity, mental activity, verbal activity. Meditation can certainly generate good samskaras. Samskaras, I would translate, tendencies or impressions. But mind doesn't always cooperate with you. You try to meditate, as I mentioned. The moment we close our eyes, we are encountering a big mental block. When you open our eyes, mind is diverted towards various external objects through these five channels: the eyes, the ears, the nostrils, the sense of taste and sense of sound, sense of vision, sense of smell, and so on. So the mind is diverted towards external objects. The moment you close your eyes, you may hear, still there will be distraction, still a lot of the mental system is diverted inward. So when the mind is drawn inward, it encounters itself. It faces itself, its own reality. Then all unwelcome thought currents, undesirable thought currents and impressions emerge in the mental system. Because these are all impressions generated by our own activities. So these conflicts are created by undesirable negative tendencies and impressions. And there are good tendencies, that's why we develop a desire to meditate, to turn to God. But there are negative tendencies which create a mental block when we try to do spiritual practices. So the only way for us to avoid this problem, to neutralize the mental block, is to generate more positive, spiritually conducive thought currents. And this is done much more easily by physical activity. The reason is very simple. You have more autonomy and freedom at the physical level. We have very little freedom at the mental level. The mind doesn't cooperate with what we want to do, but body may cooperate more or less. So that's why you find this system which I referred to. Many of the temples in India you find, and much more commonly you find among the Sikh temples, where the devotees, spiritual seekers, go and nobody will notice, nobody will instruct them. They will take a broom and clean the floor. Even if it's clean, they will do it again. Because by that, they feel they're generating some spiritual memory. It really happens. But at a physical level, we have more freedom. So what happens? Mind begins to change. Mind begins to move. And mind begins to get refined. Not only mind, memory system, our character, our attitudes begin to change. This is the most direct way of spiritual practice. Most direct, the easiest, and most natural. But very often we have the wrong notion that if I meditate on God, it is the most wonderful thing to do. It is as childish as for a kindergarten child to say, I would rather go to Oxford instead of going to the kindergarten nearby, where the mother will wake you up in the morning, bathe you, feed you, dress you up, and take the kindergarten. That's all big headache. I would rather go to Oxford directly. It doesn't happen that way. So very often we think these are direct methods, that is, meditation. I shall meditate. I shall try to raise my kundalini. In most of these institutions, of course, they are for money, so we don't have to worry about them because they are not serious. Those to go there also are not very serious all the time. So there is no problem on either side. So you can. What I want to say is this unique insight of Holy Mother into the dynamics of spiritual life. Now, where did she get this power? Now, this is what happens. When you evolve in spiritual life, many of the higher powers of mind will emerge in the inner system. Those powers are the powers of intuitive wisdom. There are three levels of human wisdom as in its evolutionary process. At the lowest level, people do things in a very irrational manner, totally opposed to reason. The second level, you think of the pros and cons, you judge things, you try to understand things, and you use your reasoning power, and then you act and speak. This is normal for all well-educated, cultured people, normal people. But there is a small group of people who develop a much higher power. That power comes as a direct result of spiritual practice. So you find some of them displaying very unique insights, even to business management. That's what you find in Holy Mother. You find there are many wonderful episodes and interesting events in the life of Holy Mother, Swami Brahmanandaji, and also Swami Sivanandaji, many other, all the direct disciples you find, also many other great monks. A kind of unique insight. That is superior to reason. That's where reason cannot reach. It is the unerring source of wisdom. Whatever you do on the basis of reason may sometimes go wrong. Reason is not the ultimate criterion. Very often people who think a lot, make a lot of preparations, and do a lot of judgment, still they commit mistakes. Because times will change, events will change, because your reasoning is based upon the present, the available level of understanding, whatever information we have got right now at our disposal. Based on that, you judge, you think, you discern. That's reason. But the circumstances will change. People's attitude will change. That's beyond your power of reasoning. Your power of reasoning is based upon the currently available information or knowledge or whatever it is. But the higher intuitive wisdom, it is unerring because it is beyond reason. It never goes wrong. It never contradicts reason, but goes beyond reason. It's called intuitive wisdom. That's how Mother is able to make some very wonderful judgments on many events which cannot be understood or explained in the light of reason. I can just quote a very famous poem by Sister Nivedita. Remember, you know, she was born in Ireland. Miss Margaret Noble. She was a disciple of Vivekananda. Maybe much more accurate to say that she was a disciple of Holy Mother, because even Vivekananda sent her to Holy Mother. And he wanted to know whether this person is the right person, is the right person for this great work for which she had come to India from Ireland, from London, of course, later. So when she went to Holy Mother, they didn't know each other's language. Mother did not know English, and she did not know Bengali. But they could communicate with each other, and they could understand with each other. And Sister Nivedita felt she was in the presence of her own mother, a mother with whom she had a much more intimate relationship than with her own biological mother. She wrote a very wonderful poem, The Foot Falls, O Mother. That's a poem. We hear them, O Mother, thy foot falls, soft, soft, through the ages, touching earth here and there, and the lotuses left on thy footprints are cities historic, ancient scriptures and poems and temples, noble strivings, stem struggles for right, will lead thee, O Mother. Thy foot falls, O grandest to drink of their meaning, grandest the vision that blindeth The thought that for man is too high will lead thee, O mother, thy footfalls. Approach you, O mother, deliverer, thy children, thy nurslings are we. On our hearts be the place for thy stepping, thine own Bhumiya Devi are we. Where lead thee, O mother, thy footfall. Bhumiya Devi, you know, Mother Earth. So, this lady who was born in a totally alien culture, different language, different food habits, everything different, she comes to India and she meets Holy Mother and she finds in her a mother with whom she had much more intimate relationship connection than with her own biological mother. Now, the reason is, on the one hand, mother had this intuitive wisdom, the wisdom that goes far beyond the power of reasoning. It is not opposed to reasoning, but it transcends the realms of reason. That's why the words of mother never went wrong. But many decisions taken by great administrators, business managers, do go wrong. Because how Napoleon was defeated in Waterloo. So they thought, but for the wet, damned land, he was speaking about. See, one of the greatest calculators the world has produced. You find some of the brightest, most brilliant people who use reasoning as they understood it. Somehow, their reasoning concealed an Achilles heel, a hidden weak point, which actually caused their downfall. That's why every clever person has something in him where he will slip down. You find the great characters in the mythology, Ravana, or maybe Hitler. Hitler refused to listen to his own attendants and his own lieutenants when they reported to him, Master Shukov has reached Berlin. He could hear the cannonade from Hitler's bunker. But this man was supposed to be, he was a monomaniac. Still, he was supposed to be not a dull person, you would admit that. But this man refused to believe that he could ever be defeated, he could ever go wrong. So that was his Achilles heel. In the story of Homer, you know, you can find the Iliad, Achilles himself had a heel that was his Achilles heel, weak point. So reasoning or cleverness, what we call efficiency, the empirical skills, the superlative powers of mind and intellect may have some problem. And that problem may be its Achilles heel, may bring it downfall. But a spiritual teacher, a spiritual person's wisdom is not the wisdom of reason, it's the wisdom of intuition, where they could see things not with their eyes, not with their external eyes, but with their inner eyes of intuitive wisdom. That's why you find in mother's life there are many, many wonderful things. So maybe mother's life and teachings present a new paradigm for the modern world. I mean, if you take a closer look at mother's life and her invisibility, with all these great spiritual achievements, she was totally hidden, self-concealed, not assertive, the opposite of modern feminist, paradigm, so to speak. No offense meant. No. I mean, all the greatness, but this greatness of a motherly greatness, where you cannot confront a person who is so great, so affectionate, and so much free from any kind of external show of affection. That's one thing. If you show it, then it is only 99%. If you don't show, it is 100%. So you find in mother, in this, all these great spiritual achievements, which helped her, remember, to run this huge monastic organization, which had some of India's brightest men of 20th century, at least till 1950s. If you look at the first half of 20th century, those who joined Ramakrishna Order, inspired by Vivekananda, some of them were among the brightest men, and of course, after the Sarada Mutha was born, some of the greatest women that India produced. But she was, for all of them, the last word, the final source of wisdom, inspiration, and instruction. That's why all this greatness, still total freedom from any kind of assertiveness. Even the firm language in which she instructed the disciple who approached her. See, we had to work in the hospital. Sri Ramakrishna didn't ask her to work in the hospital, running schools and all that. So mother said, but that is where Sri Ramakrishna stood. And this is where you stand. So for you to evolve to the next level of your own spiritual evolution, you have to start with your kindergarten. And the kindergarten is some kind of noble activity. Because physical activity, physical service will directly be converted into spiritual energy. So that's one way, a refining process. Physical energy can be converted into spiritual energy. You have wonderful health, lot of energy, enthusiasm, efficiency. Put it at the service of some great cause. Then the physical energy immediately becomes spiritual energy. So that's the dynamics of Vivekananda's Karma Yoga. And how mother tells in strong, in no uncertain terms, strong language instructs her disciple that this is the only way for you to evolve. You have to go to the kindergarten to begin your education. You can't directly go to the university. So this spiritual judgment, this spiritual intuitive wisdom, that was her hallmark, and that's what made her the mother of all. There are many incidents in her life where she displayed her universality of outlook. See, there was one disciple. Mother had asked that person to bring some dhoti. Dhoti is, you know, the normally cotton clothing that Indians wear. In those days, you know, Manchester grew at the cost of India's weavers. The British, they cut off the fingers of India's silk, India's cotton manufacturers, India's traditional craftsmen. I don't want to go into those details. Anyway, so India's cotton, traditional cotton industry, Dhaka, muslin, all that, silk clothes, which could be put into one small tube. India, you know, even Shankaracharya's Saundarya Lehari, Ananda Lehari refers to silk clothing of Varanasi and Kanchi. You find that is 8th century AD. You find references to India's silk trade, India's cotton industry, even the early writings of Megasthenes, who wrote Indicus in the 305 BC. He was the Greek ambassador to Chandragupta's court in India. So these are all history anyway. So one funny incident is there. That's what I'm going to refer to. So one mother asked one disciple to bring a piece of cloth. So, you know, the British have successfully destroyed Indian cloth industry. And Indians were importing dhotis from Manchester. Think of it. Indians, it's like Americans importing McDonald's hamburger from London or Starbucks from London. Indians were importing dhotis, which no Englishman ever wore, from Manchester. So all the best dhotis came from Manchester. So mother asked one of her disciples to bring a good piece of high quality dhoti. Didn't mention high quality dhoti. She meant a good quality. This man was a great patriot. So Gandhi was going all over India, spreading this khadi movement, you know. Khadi was some kind of a coarse cloth, which was cotton industry, cottage industry, you know. Gandhi developed this to give job to the poor people in the villages. So raw cotton was unrefined cotton, used to make rough, crude, a kind of, not very crude, but now it's much more refined, more, it's being now mechanized. But in those days, it was manually woven and manufactured, the khadi clothing. So this man, Mother's disciple, was a great patriot, maybe Gandhian. So he didn't want to buy something that came from Manchester. He bought Indian khadi. That is a, his show of patriotism. So mothers, why did you wear, why did you bring this one? Not of a high quality. Then the mother's disciple said, well, mother, this is khadi. The other higher, better dhotis are coming from England. As a show of patriotism, maybe he expected mother to congratulate him. But mother's approach was different. So he said, these Englishmen are manufacturing our dhotis, we don't want. Mother, they are also my children. That's mother's response. He said, Englishmen are also my children. So the narrow, maybe not narrow, but the natural understanding of patriotism, love for one's own country, love for one's own people, even grievance against the destruction of one's own national cloth industry. These ideas never crossed mother's mind. She looked upon the whole humanity as her children. So patriotism, nationalism, identity, one's own culture, these ideas never crossed the mother's mind, because mother's mind never makes distinctions between her children. Some children may be not very good in schools, some may be very good, but mother doesn't make that distinction. That is the uniqueness of mother. So mother was the mother of the whole humanity. So on the one hand, this motherly love and affection. On the other hand, the realism that enabled her to make such wonderful judgments, even in guiding this huge global monastic fraternity, that makes her life and teachings much more complex. The very simplicity of it, of her personality, made it much more complex for us to understand and explain the real depth and grandeur of her spiritual dimension. Thank you. Namaskar. Om Shanti, 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 Harihi Om Tatsat. Sri Ramakrishna Panamastu.